Don Zimmer has pretty much done it all during his 53 years in baseball. He tripled in his first Major League at-bat, homered in his first American League at-bat, played every position except pitcher during a 12-year Major League career. He's been a winning manager, and he's announced his retirement more often than a heavyweight fighter. Now he is achieving new fame as Joe Torre's bench coach and confidant on the New York Yankees. He's also one of the sport's most colorful characters and a wonderful storyteller, which is very evident in his new book called Zim, A Baseball Life, written with Bill Madden and published by Total Sports Illustrated. It is my great honor to welcome to New York & Company the first Mets third baseman ever, and there have been hundreds since, and one of the best managers the Cubs ever had, Don Zimmer. Hi.
Thanks for being on your show.
You've managed the Red Sox and the Cubs, two teams that people think may be cursed. You were seriously beaned twice, and then you were the opening day third baseman for the hapless 1962 Mets. So did you ever feel like you were born under a cloud?
No, just the opposite. I've had a couple of tough injuries as a player. I've been fired as a manager. I've been released as a player. To think that I'm going to Yankee Stadium this evening to put on a uniform for the 53rd year, I think I'm one of the luckiest guys that ever wanted to be in baseball.
What did you imagine it was going to be like when you signed your first contract? It was with the Dodgers.
Well, I was when I was 8, 9 years old, my father put a glove on my hand, and I played softball on the same team with my father and Pete Rose's father. And I was like 14 years old or so, and when I was playing with them, and I learned the game playing with my dad and his friends.
Did you think you were going to be a big star?
Not really at that time. But then when I got to be a junior and senior in high school, I would go watch the Cincinnati Reds play and so forth and so on. And the more I watched them, I said, maybe someday I'll be out there. And I was kind of not a cocky kid, but I had confidence, and I thought I could play a little bit. And luckily, here I am.
Well, the Dodgers signed you as the heir to Pee Wee Reese at shortstop. How much were you paid for your first season in the minor leagues?
My first year, I got $140 a month. I think meal money was $1 or $1.25. I know you're smiling. I think my third year, actually my second full year in Elmira, is the year that I got married in 1951.
At home plate.
That's right. And I think I got all the way up to $300 a month. I thought I was a millionaire.
You say in the book that the most you ever made was $30,000 a season, and that was during your last year when you played in Japan, and $9,000 more than you ever earned in the majors. Were you paid low for those times, or was $21,000 a typical salary?
Well, I was making $11,000 when we left Brooklyn and went to Los Angeles.
$11,000
a year.
I don't even know what that is in today's dollars, but it can't be very much.
No, and when we got to the Coliseum in L.A., the first year out there, I hit 17 home runs and drove in about 70 runs, and Buzzy Bavese gave me an $8,000 raise. I got to 19. And 19,000, I thought that I was on top of the world. And I guess I made 19,000 for the next 6, 7 years because I got traded different places and they don't want to cut you. So I kind of made the same salary for about 6, 7 years.
And is that because you were a 235 lifetime hitter?
I would say that's got a lot to do with it.
But you were good enough to keep on in the majors until your body gave out.
I feel this way. For being a 235 hitter and so forth, I'm a lucky man of still being in the game. But when I can look back and say that I played with the 1955 Brooklyn Dodgers, to me that means a lot to me and some of the great players that were on that club, and that's something I'll never forget.
Well, that was the first Dodger team to ever win a World Series, and you were the starting second baseman. Jackie had been moved off of second base at that point?
Jackie was hurt at the time. And I started at second base against a left-hander in the seventh game of the World Series. Judd Junior Gilliam started in left field. And I think we had a 1-0 lead. And about the sixth inning, Casey brought in a right-hander to face me with a man on third and one out. Austin took me out of the game, sent up a left-handed pinch hitter. And Then he brought in Gilliam to play second, Amoros to play left field, and Amoros, being a left-handed thrower with his glove on his right hand, could make that catch off of Yogi Berra and double somebody off of first base.
One of the greatest catches in the history of the World Series. So you say that your major contribution was being taken out of the game.
I would say at that time, yes.
Well, what is the biggest thrill? Is it having all those World Series rings? Was it better than the year that you managed the Cubs to a division championship?
I've had some good days in baseball. I've hit two home runs in a game against Sal Magley and finally beat the Giants over in the Polo Grounds. But when it comes down to one particular season or player, it was 1959 with the Cubs. And the reason, not 1959, I'm wrong here.
No, you were 1989. Yes.
1989. Everybody in America picked the Cubs last. And to think that the team that I had, we won the Eastern Division Championship with the Cubs, has to go down as one of the biggest thrills that I've had in the game, plus many others.
But that was a team that had few stars. It was that's why nobody picked it.
Well,
and then it looks like if Andre Dawson had remained healthy, you might have actually wound up playing in the World Series with Detroit.
Andre Dawson was a great player.
He was the best player on the team.
He was something. He was a great player, and unfortunately, during this playoffs, every time he come up, the game was on the line, and my heart bled for him. He just couldn't get a hit. Just got in a slump at the wrong time, and it was in the playoffs. But he was a great player and a great human being, and that was just a great year.
My guest is Don Zimmer, who has written autobiography, A Baseball Life, called Zim, written with the help of Bill Madden and published by Total/Sports Illustrated. One of the thrills must have been stealing home 10 times in a season. That's when you were in the minor leagues. But nowadays, nobody steals home. What do you think happened?
Well, number one, most pitchers today, they don't wind up with a man on third. They pitch out of a stretch. So if you pitch out of a stretch, you can't steal home, with one exception. That's if there's men on first and third and you try a double steal.
Right, and then you have the delayed steal.
Right, but I mean, the only way you can steal home is a guy's in his windup. And we had that happen to us not long ago. Mondesi from Toronto stole home against one of our rookie pitchers that was in his windup, and he caught him napping. And when I stole home 10 times one year in the minor leagues, it was because pitchers had big windups and slow deliveries, and you got to have a little nerve. You can't call time out in the middle of a ball game and say to the manager, "Is it all right if I try to steal home?" This is something you do on your own.
And we saw you played on Dodger team where Jackie Robinson stole home on a regular basis.
Lord only knows how many times he stole home. He drove pitchers crazy, without a doubt. Jackie was a big man.
Why isn't there more of that today? You have a reputation for being a gambler. I suspect that you wouldn't suggest something wild like that to Joe.
Well, Curry. Number one, the running game is much more of a running game today than ever, and pitchers have to learn how to unload the ball quickly. Usually you don't steal off of catchers. Usually you steal off of pitchers. And if a pitcher's got a slow delivery or a big arm sling back behind him, that's when a guy steals bases. And naturally, you got pitching coaches trying to teach pitchers how to unload to prevent stolen bases, because speed is a big part of the game today.
You are one of those rare ball players who didn't have to work as a truck driver or at your father's furniture store during the off season. You worked at baseball full time, even though you're making so little money.
Well, when I have the distinction to say that I never earned a check out of baseball, people say, "Well, did you come from a rich family?" No, that's the furthest thing in the world. When I was a young player, I was lucky enough to be asked to go to Cuba to play in the Winter League. When I was like 21, 22 years old, they wanted all ex-major leaguers or major leaguers in Cuba.
Potential.
Yeah, it was a great league. And Al Campanis from the Dodgers recommended me to go there, and I finally went to Havana, and I played there 2 years as a young player with great players. And
a mix of Cubans and U.S. players?
There was only like maybe three or four Americans on each team. It was maybe more than that, six or seven Americans on each team, but guys like Aparicio and Minoso, and I played with and against all those kind of players. When Castro come in, that was the end of the Cuban baseball for us. I went to Puerto Rico and played a couple of years. And then they started having instructional leagues in Florida where I live. And I always wound up with some kind of an instructional league as an instructor or a coach in Florida, and that's why I never had to go out and really get a real job.
When you came to the Dodgers, did you feel like you had made it to the big city? Because you were moving to Bay Ridge in Brooklyn, weren't you? You lived on Fort Hamilton Park.
Well, when I finally got to the Dodgers in 1954, I had spring training in 53 with the Brooklyn Dodgers, but 54 when I finally was brought up to the Brooklyn Dodgers, when I can stop and I can look at Billy Cox and Pee Wee Reese and Jackie Robinson, Hodges, Snyder, Ferrillo, Erskine, Nuke, Drysdale, and I can go on and on. I mean, that's when I knew I arrived as a major league player, when I was on that club.
Well, that Dodger team was a kind of collection of all-stars. Many of them are in the Hall of Fame, and yet they only won their first World Series in 1955. Was there something wrong with the team, or was baseball different then?
Nope. I just think you're talking about two great teams in the 50s with the Yankees and the Brooklyn Dodgers.
And the Giants were in chop liver either.
Oh, no. They were a good ball club. But when we would play the Yankees, some way they found a way to edge us out. And I just think it was two great clubs. And in 1955, we finally beat the Yankees for the first time.
Well, people made a big thing about a Subway Series, but they were the regular thing in the 40s and the 50s. And when you think of the center fielders in New York City, I thought Duke Snider was the best because I was a Dodger fan, but obviously I've come to my senses. There were guys named Mickey Mantle and Willie Mays out there. Also, the two greatest catchers of their time, Yogi Berra and Roy Campanella. It was an amazing time.
Yes, it was. When you start thinking in practically the same town, three Hall of Fame center fielders like the three you just named, going back to Duke Snider, I don't think Duke Snider really got the recognition as being as great a center fielder as the other two guys, Mantle and Mays, mainly because of the ballparks. Ebbets Field had a small ballpark.
We'll come back to Don Zimmer, his book Zim, A Baseball Life, written with Bill Madden. Back with Don Zimmer, whose baseball career has spanned 53 years. He went from being a top prospect to a near tragedy after being beaned in the minor leagues and then being beaned again. Played for 12 years on 325 teams, including including a team in Tokyo, which must have felt kind of like when you were playing in Havana, although a little different. He tells his story in a book called Zim, A Baseball Life, which is published by Total Sports Illustrated. I just want to go back to the old days for a moment more. People are always trying to compare old ball players with modern ball players. Is it possible? Can we assume that a Stan Musial would be a superstar today, or Ted Kluszewski? Would a Yul Blackwell be just as effective today as he was then?
Oh, I think so. Without a doubt, excuse me, and I also think that the great players today could have played with the great players then. I mean, you got the Marises, the Mantles, you could go on down, the Musials, the DiMaggios, and all of them, but when you start talking about today's players, the Bonzes and the Griffies, and just go on and on, I mean, those kind of guys that we're naming could play at any time in any era.
But they're different because they work out, don't they? In the old days, players weren't in the kind of condition that a ball player is expected to be.
There's no question that players today are probably in the best condition of any ball player at any time. And mainly they have facilities for players to work out. And there's so much money involved. why wouldn't you work out to keep yourself in great shape? Years ago, when the season's over, you took your glove and spikes and you went home and put them in the cupboard and you went to work for the winter. And spring training was for just what it says, spring training. If you was 3 pounds overweight, you went into spring training to lose those 3 pounds and you took your glove and spikes with you. There was no weight rooms and lifting and this and that. There was none of that. And today it's just different.
Well, it's different in other ways, too. Ball players were part of the community. At least with the Dodgers, you lived in Bay Ridge with half the team. They all lived in apartments nearby.
We had a group up there of Pee Wee, Hodges, Erskine, myself, Eddie Roebuck, Russ Meyer. It must have been 8 or 9 of us that lived right in the little Bay Ridge area. And I can remember going 3 or 4 cars at a time, loaded, going through Prospect Park.
You mean you just carpool?
Yeah, sure. Because, you know, we all lived so close together, there was no sense taking 9 cars for 9 people.
Do you miss that?
Oh, absolutely.
Because there was a real sense of community, and the people in Brooklyn knew you, too. And you could all see each other every night if you wanted to, or you could avoid some players if you just didn't want to go over to their house.
The game has changed. There's no doubt about it. And when you went into hotels, most of the hotels had big lobbies where 5 guys would be over in a corner and this and that. Hotels we go into today sometimes don't even have a lobby.
Mm-hmm.
Airplanes. You can only talk to one person on an airplane. That's a guy sitting next to you. We used to go by train where you might have 5 or 6 guys at one table back in the club car playing cards or shooting a breeze back there. I mean, there's no question. It's different. You roll with the punches.
They say that ball players today are harder to manage than the players of the past. Do you agree that the guaranteed multi-million dollar contracts just make them less likely to do whatever a manager tells them to do?
I think managing today would be the toughest in the world as it stands right today with multi-year contracts and so forth. You know, you say you got a guy that's giving you a problem. If I gave Mr. Alston, Walt Alston, a problem when I was a kid, he'd say, go to St. Paul, son, or go to Mobile, Alabama. Well, if you got a 3-year guaranteed contract, he can't send me to St. Paul. And I think a player knows that. Not that a player causes problems, but today, to me, the job Joe Torre has to do, or any other manager, today is the toughest managing at any time in baseball, I believe.
So when you took over, when Joe got sick, that was something that you really rued having to do?
Well, number one, I never wanted to do it because the only reason I was doing it is because Joe was sick, and that was a terrible thing. I had a bad leg. I couldn't hardly walk. That didn't help things. I'll put it this way. I had a guy the day before yesterday said, you ought to be managing. I said, what's that? He said, you ought to be managing. Would you manage again? I said, I'm too old to manage. I said, I don't want to go through that no more.
You'd rather be a bench coach where you don't have to worry about handling all the PR. You don't have to worry about the press. In the old days, if you wanted to, and you were famous for this, you'd just simply tell all the reporters to get out.
Well, as a manager, you have to cater to the press to a certain amount of time. As a coach, you do what you want. And I mean, I try to be nice to the media, but they don't have to come to me. They go to the manager and let the manager worry about that. I had to worry about that for 12 years. Let Joe Torre worry about it.
But, you know, when you said that the baseball players are different, I'm reminded of a story that you tell here about Billy Lowe's in 1954 when he wanted a dog.
Well, he was a character. Billy Lowe's was a character. There's
no doubt about it. A modern-day manager would recognize Billy Lowe's as somebody who might be on a team today?
Well, I think you have characters today. I mean, David Wells, to me, is a character, but he can pitch.
Well, tell a story about Billy Lowe's. He wanted to buy this dog, and he didn't have the money. In those days, nobody had any money in baseball.
We had our own plane at the time. We had our own plane, a conveyor, and we were in Cincinnati, which is my hometown, and Billy was walking down Fifth and Vine in Cincinnati, and he went by a pet shop, and he saw this little dog, pedigree of some type, and he went in to buy the dog, and I don't know, I think it was like a $300 dog. Well, he didn't have that kind of money on him. Buzzy Bavese, our general manager, he was with us on the trip. So he went to Buzzy and he said, Buzzy, lend me $300 till we get home. And Buzzy said, for what? He said, I want to buy this dog and take it home with me. And Buzzy said, you're not buying, you're not buying any dog to take home on an airplane. Well, Billy Lowe's was about 12-4 at the time, getting ready to probably be picked on the All-Star team. And when when Buzzy refused him the $300, he said, well, I won't pitch no more. And then the story was, well, you got a chance to win 20 games. He said, I don't want to win 20 games. He said, if you win 20 games, they expect you to do it every year. But you'd have to know Billy Lowe's to know what he meant. He was a very, very smart pitcher out on that mound.
Yeah, he was one of the best. Well, when you say he was a smart pitcher, do you think pitchers were smarter then? Because you see pitchers today, many people talk about how pitchers today are afraid to pitch inside. They're afraid to do all sorts of things they might have done in the past. If there were a Sal Magley today, he'd probably be in a fight every day.
I would. Yeah, you're just about right. The barber, he'd give guys shaves today, and there would be some brawls. But when you start talking about thinking men's pitchers, I see pitchers today, they like to go up in the clubhouse and lay around for seven innings and this and that, and they watch it on TV because the story you get, they can see better on TV. Well, I think you see better in the dugout. And if you want to talk about a thinking man's pitcher, think of Greg Maddux, who's probably been the best pitcher in the last 12 years of baseball. Mm-hmm. Watch where he sits every day the Atlanta Braves play. He's not up in the clubhouse. He is on the bench every game that he pitches or he doesn't pitch. When he's not pitching, he's right on the bench watching everything that goes on. And I think that that's also helped him being the pitcher that he is.
But isn't that what the best players have always done? Ted Williams was famous for watching pitchers warm up to see what pitches were working for them.
Oh, no question. I mean,
but why don't more players do that?
When you were on the on-deck circle, all you had one thing to do is to watch the pitcher throw the ball. Today, it's got so scientific, hitters don't even watch the pitchers warming up. They want to holler up to our guy that we have behind home plate, and for him to tell us, or the hitter, how hard the guy's throwing. 91, 89, 92. Does he have a sinker? I mean, I think you can see that yourself, but that's the way the game is. It's very scientific today.
My guest is Don Zimmer. His book, Zim, A Baseball Life, written with Bill Madden. You're listening to New York & Company on AM 820 WNYC. We're live online at WNYC.org. And I invite you to join us for a little while. We'll take your calls at 212-267-WNYC. That's area code 212-267-9692. Did things change when you became a manager? Because you see everything from a different perspective, don't you? A guy who's a wonderful character suddenly becomes a pain in the butt?
Oh, sure. The old saying is, when you're a manager, you got to treat everybody alike. That's the furthest thing from the truth in the world. You got 25 different personalities out there. And if I'm the manager, what is my job? My number one job is to get the best out of every player that's on that team. Some guys, you can go up and kind of punch them in the gut or something and say something to them that really gets them going. You might not be able to say that to the next person. If you did, he might melt on you. He might just quit on you. You might have to go up and put your arm around a certain guy. To me, if they have to kiss him on the neck or something, and that's the best way to get the best out of him, that's part of managing, and that's what it's all about.
Casey Stengel used to say the real trick is keeping the guy who hates you away from the other guys. When you were managing the Red Sox, you had Bill Lee and you had a whole bunch of other players who got together and they were in kind of rebellion because they had won.
Well, stop and think who they were.
Bill Lee.
Fergie Jenkins, and Rick Weiss. They were three of my starters. I would have loved to have them all win 17 to 18 games. I might still be managing the Red Sox if that was the case. But they couldn't win. They couldn't win in Fenway. And I had to do something about it or we're going down the drain. And I had enough guts to take them out of the rotation, even though they were good pitchers. I took them out of the rotation with the recommendation of Johnny Padres, who was in our minor leagues, to bring up some young pitchers to pitch in their spots. And those kids that we brought up kept us in the race. And naturally, me taking the three star pitchers out, I don't know nothing about pitching. I'm a dummy. I'm a rockhead. I'm a gerbil. I'm this. And that's what I heard from all of them. But that's the way the game goes. I did what I wanted to do.
Well, it's what management always goes through, and it makes some tough decisions.
That's true.
But do you think that because you're an old-style manager, because that's the way you've been described, an old-style manager, that you were going through that period where baseball was going through this transition?
No, I think I could manage today. I'm 70 years old. I could manage today. I think I know how to treat ball players today, just like I did 18, 19 years ago.
You played for some of the best managers in baseball.
And
Casey
I played with
Stengel,
some tough
for example.
Ones.
Was Walt Alston a great manager?
He wasn't when he got there, but the old saying is, great players make a good manager, and there's nothing. That's the truth. I managed in San Diego, and we lost 104 games. I go to the Red Sox, and we win 99 games. All of a sudden, I got smart.
Mm-hmm.
I was no smarter in Boston than I was in San Diego, except I had better players.
So what makes a really good manager? Strategy, the ability to motivate the players?
Joe Torre,
Joe Torre is a great
Torre
example, because I think
example.
We all agree he's a great manager.
Joe Torre came here, what was the headlines? Clueless Joe, because he never won.
Because he had done poorly with the Mets, and he had done poorly with St. Louis.
Now he comes in
was
here.
Was it the Braves?
Yes. He's got a good club, but he knows how to handle people. Joe Torre is probably one of the best guys that I've ever been around of knowing how to handle men, and he does a tremendous job. It's just like going out and say, go play, and 27 outs, we go home. There's a lot of insight to it of treating people the way they should be treated, again, to get the best out of them. And Joe Torre is very good at that, and consequently, Joe Torre today is at the top of his game as a manager.
Was Stengel as difficult to understand as some people say?
Yes, but when you got around him a little bit, you knew what he was saying. That's like Yogi. Yogi makes all those crazy. But when you're with Yogi, you know exactly what he meant.
Well, Yogi strikes me as one of the smartest people that ever was. All of those Yogi-isms are really, the reason we remember them is because they're wonderful.
Exactly.
Not because they're stupid.
When you listen to Yogi and you start laughing, but you know exactly what he meant.
Could you put on the headphones, please? We have some calls coming in for Don Zimmer, whose book is called Zim, A Baseball Life. Joe from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Thank you. Don Zimmer, I've known your career for 50 years, and I've always admired you. I thought you'd like to hear about a conversation I have with my friend Sam Nahum. Sam was an old pitcher who pitched in the late and early 40s. He was with Brooklyn. He was with Philadelphia. And last night, as a matter of fact, he was talking about the psychology of pitching and the philosophy of pitching, and he mentioned Lon Warnke of the Cubs, who was one of the most intelligent pitchers he ever ran across, he ever met. And he too would sit in the dugout and study the pitchers. He would study the batters. He would study the game, and he knew the game. Then he discussed his own career when he didn't last too long. He was in the major leagues for 5 years, but he felt that the lack of instruction. There were no pitching coaches in those days. There was very little instruction. He was a lower talent, and he came up, and he had to do it on his own. And he felt that if he had better instruction, he would have done much better in the major league.
Isn't that why the Dodgers and a few other teams were better than other teams, because they did have instruction in the minor leagues?
I feel like coming up in the Dodger organization, I've always said that I probably come up in the greatest organization there was when it come to teaching how to play. There's no question that today, I always said, why wouldn't minor league clubs have an infield instructor, an outfield instructor, a pitching coach, a hitting coach? And we didn't have that when I played. But today, that thing has really changed. I mean, I don't think we have a minor league club in the organization that doesn't have a pitching coach, a hitting coach, maybe a revolving infield coach that goes around to all the clubs. That was almost a thing of the past, the days that I played. But now you have it, and I think that's money well spent.
We don't have much time, but a listener wants to know about how hard it is to handle all the language barriers and cultural differences in the clubhouse today. Today we have Japanese players. We have players from all over Latin America. The game has changed an awful lot.
I would say that it's a difference. I mean, we used to have a little fun when Arabu was here. Joe would say to Mel Stottlemyre, go out and talk to him. Well, Mel would start jogging out. Well, it has to be a joke. What was he going to talk about? I mean, Arabu didn't understand English, and Mel couldn't speak Japanese. So I often wondered what they had to say.
Well, people always wonder what the manager and the bench coach are saying. Are they talking about what they had for dinner last night, or are they actually talking about strategy?
A little bit of each. We'll have to be talking what time we tee off tomorrow or what movie we're going to. You know, most of it's baseball, but, I mean, you can't sit there for nine innings and think it's all baseball. I mean, we have fun.
You keep on retiring and then coming back. Is it hard for you to stay away from the game?
I would say yes. Last year I thought it was the end because I wasn't feeling well. My leg was gone. Right now I'm feeling good.
You're walking fine.
You know, I'm getting along a lot better. And the old saying is if I feel this good at the end of the year and the Yankees want me back, I might be back again.
Just one more question. Did Billy Lowe's ever get his dog?
No, he didn't.
Don Zimmer's book, written with Bill Madden, with a foreword by Joe Torre, is Zim, A Baseball Life. It's published by Total Sports Illustrated. Thank you so much.
Thank you for being on.
I've met a few. I've had my share of men kicking my face.